Our modern framework preserves the work of representation through constituency casework, a vital tool for building confidence in our democracy. Before I was first elected to Parliament, I did not anticipate just how effective the platform of being an MP would prove in tackling the many and varied difficult circumstances faced by constituents. Whether what is at stake is a license to drive a bus or a life-saving drug, a bogus educational course, or a constituent's access to benefits, every successful case shows that the system continues to work. Redress of grievance is still achieved.
Well, I think all sensible people have the British Constitution as one of their hobbies. It is the most interesting matter to discuss and be informed about. As Dicey said, Dicey argued, it is Parliament that is the defender of the liberties of the people, of our ancient constitution and of our freedoms. I give way.
Well, welcome to the next edition of the podcast Why Parliament Works. I'm absolutely delighted to have as my guest today Carolyn Harris, the Member of Parliament for Swansea East. Carolyn, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You have been the most effective campaigner since you were elected. You're really good at working cross-party to get things done and persuading people that your causes are worth backing and aren't particularly party political. So what I want to discuss today is why Parliament works on a cross-party basis with people coming together rather than the more adversarial side that people tend to see at Prime Minister's Questions.
Yeah, well, I don't think Prime Minister's Questions is at all reflective of how Parliament works. It's a little bit of theatre for a Wednesday lunchtime. It's not the real Parliament.
But what I'd like to start with is how you work in your own constituency, because you're a champion for your constituents in Swansea. You're good at getting things put right for them. And I was very surprised when I was first elected how effective it was writing a letter with the portcullis on it and finding that people actually did things. Has that surprised you, or did you know before you got in?
I didn't know that was going to happen. I mean, I've come from a really working class background. You know, I can remember times when I'd be worried, did I have enough money to put in the meter in the winter because of the electricity and keeping the family warm. So in my constituency, I know that there is poverty and I know there's deprivation and I know where the social problems are because I've lived it all my life. So when I first became an MP, it was about using that position to get the resources to make things better for other people. And once I've done it, it's like anything else. When it's tried and tested, all of a sudden people start coming to you with resources and asking you if you can help them rather than you having to ask somebody for resources. And it's all down to the headed note paper and actually saying, I'm working with a Member of Parliament. And it makes a huge, huge difference.
And people are quite receptive, aren't they, that if you go to the local council, and realistically a lot of what we do is with local councils, they do want to help the residents. It's not that they're there thinking, how do we make residents' lives miserable? Just inevitably, in any human system, mistakes are made, and we're the ones who have the opportunity to try and get it put right.
In a lot of cases, they don't really realise that there are issues in the first place. I always remember someone saying to me at one point, when I was doing some work around social exclusion, and I worked with a family and said that they were socially excluded. And the woman said to me, how dare you tell me I'm excluded? I live the way I live because I want to live like this. So I'm not excluded. This is my choice. And I think we have to acknowledge that people don't always recognise, a lot of women don't recognise they're victims of domestic abuse. It's how their families have always lived. So we have to be careful that we're not trying to get people to admit or to acknowledge something which they don't want to acknowledge. And local authorities and those who make decisions locally have to be very careful in how much they actually try to encourage people to accept something that they don't want to accept. And we as politicians, it's our role to give them the opportunity to make better choices. And that's what I try to do.
Yes, and to intermediate between them an officialdom, which can seem quite frightening to people who have perhaps spent their lives trying to avoid officialdom, and that we're there always to back our constituents and support them in their argument.
Yeah, and to make sure that sometimes in life you get dealt a bad hand for whatever reason, and it's like having the key, isn't it? The key, we haven't got the answer, but we've got the key to unlock the conversation, which will eventually find out for a solution to a problem, whether it's one person's problem or it's a community's problems. It's just about opening that communication.
And what I've noticed you're so good at is getting the tone of conversations right. Because as a Member of Parliament, people ask you for lots of things and lots of things you think they ought to have, but you've got no executive authority to tell anybody to do anything. So you have to do it by persuasion. And I imagine you've been very good at persuading the local council and other administrators that they want to help people and it's in their interest too.
Yeah, I think it's about treating people with respect, but acknowledging that you will not get anything done on your own. You have to work with other people. And those other people may be businesses, they may be government offices, they may be government agencies. It doesn't harm to be nice to people and to talk to people with the aim of getting a better outcome for whatever that bad situation is. There's nothing worse than if you've got a bad situation and you add swear words and anger and, you know, you've got to be respectful of everyone to get anything done. I always say you get far more with honey than you do with vinegar, and it's very true.
Well, I think that's exactly right. It's exactly the phrase Jim Shannon used in the podcast I did with him, and he again is somebody who's very good at cross-party working, which is what I wanted to move on to, because your campaigns and your first successful campaign as a Member of Parliament was in getting support for children's funerals. And what I thought was so clever about that was not just that you got cross-party support, but you held politicians' feet to the fire. So you asked a question, a Prime Minister's question. And the Prime Minister obviously said that she thought this was something that should be put right. The Prime Minister is never going to stand up and say, I don't want to do anything to help on that. And then it ran into the long grass, didn't it? You were amazingly persistent. So tell me about the process. Tell me what drove you to do it and how you felt the system operated.
Well, what drove me to do it was my own personal situation when I lost my son, and he was 8 years of age. We were a youngish married couple. My husband worked on low income. I was a barmaid. We didn't have residual income to spend on a funeral. So when we lost Martin and that bill came, and I can see the bill now for £1,800. £1,800 back in 1989 was an immense amount of money. And I remember thinking, you know, how on earth am I going to get this? And it was purely because the local community, it was my husband's pub, actually. It had what they call a whip round. And that's how we used to pay Martin's funeral. And my husband went to the bank and borrowed the rest of the money. And that's how we paid for Martin's funeral. So when I started talking about being in that terribly dark place, and I wanted to do something which would stop other parents feeling that desperation. And when I started talking about it, I started getting all this mail from people who said, you know, they'd had debt collectors chasing them because they hadn't been able to pay for their child's funeral. We'd had, you know, situations where they'd gone and taken out really expensive payday loans to pay for their child's funeral. I think the worst case was when people had actually had what we call environment funerals now. At the time, it was called a pauper's funeral. And, you know, I think as a parent, you just always want the best for your children. So that if the last thing that you do for them is a funeral, you want it to be the best it can be. So I just couldn't give up on that, because I knew every day there are children who are leaving this world, and we owe them the dignity of having a funeral, but we also owe the parents the dignity of not having to worry about paying for that funeral. Because I think the worry is what makes the grief so much more intense. And I think, well, as a mother who lost a child, I remember saying, I'll never worry about anything again. But in reality, you worry more about everything, because that safety net of these things happen to other people and not to me, that's gone. So even now, if my son is late home, I don't think or he's late, the bus is late, or he's been held up or something, I automatically go to something terrible has happened because you've been there once and you're terrified you're going to get there again. So not having to worry about a funeral was the least I could do for anybody in that position.
But it must have been the most emotionally draining campaign for you, because it's the worst thing that can happen to a parent is the loss of a child, the death of a child at any age, let alone at the age of 8, at a very young age. And it must have been very hard for you with all those memories coming back and constant reminder of it as you were campaigning day to day.
Yeah, and I had this, I was talking to somebody about this today, about when I lost Martin, the local paper knocked the door and said, could they have a photograph of him? And I can remember being absolutely beside myself that I didn't want my son to be on the paper. I didn't want him, I didn't want his passing to be a story. I didn't want to share it. It was my grief. I didn't want anyone else to own it. But when I started talking about it, then I had to share Martin. And I found for about a year, it was really difficult that I'd shared Martin with the world, if you like. So now the whole of the United Kingdom was seeing photographs of my baby, and I had to share him. But that was the biggest sacrifice I had to make in order to get the fund, was to share Martin. And it was painful, but I'm fine now. But in the early days, to see his photograph on the news or on the papers, it was literally would take my breath away. I'd feel a sharp pain in my chest. But I'm fine about it now.
Well, you're amazingly brave. And I think that's what encouraged people to support you, was the obvious courage you were showing and the rightness of your campaign to help parents in a similar situation. But it must have got very frustrating when you got those early promises of action and then nothing happened and you had to keep on at it.
Yeah, I think I remember the first budget when I was expecting something to be in there and it wasn't in there. And I literally can remember sitting on the second row and throwing daggers at Philip Hammond, because I really thought it was going to be in there. And I think that's probably the angriest I've ever been. But, you know, these things take time, and what I was asking for was something which needed government departments to get together and discuss this. Once it did start having those conversations, and it was Philip Lee, the first minister I went to see, and then Ed Agar took over. And once Ed Agar took over, it was all different ball game, because things started to move then. And I worked really well with Ed, and I would tell him what it felt like and what we needed, and Ed delivered. And you know, David Gork was. I also had a meeting with him, and I think once people were asking me the questions about why is this important, it's very difficult then to say we're not going to do this, because it is something that every parent would absolutely dread. You know, it's the worst thing that can happen.
Yes.
So it's difficult to say no to.
And the amount of public money involved is, what, £30 million a year? It's not...
it's not a huge amount of money.
Well, we've got so used to spending tens of billions in the last year that...
yeah, but I mean, I'd even got down to the point, I mean, I call them fag paper calculations, if you like, but I would think, right, if that child was born, there'd be family allowance... family allowance in my day was child support. So how much money would that cost the government? Now, if that child has passed away at that age, and I'd spend evenings going through and doing these workings out and trying to find the cheapest way for it to happen. In the end, I need no worried about it, because the government went over and above on what I was asking for, and I'll always be grateful for that.
Well, I think it's down to your dogged campaigning and, dare I say, your charm, because you got lots of people to support you. Who may well not have thought about the issue before. And you built up considerable cross-party support. And that's a great achievement, because although there are lots of cross-party friendships, there is a degree to which members of Parliament are also instinctively tribal. And you managed to overcome that, which I think was a great success.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's tribal in the sense that we... different political parties, but we're all human beings, and when you appeal to someone's I don't even want to say better nature, because most people in here are really nice people, just that we have different political viewpoints, but we're still human beings. And having a conversation with someone about something you were passionate about, they may well be as passionate, and the only way to get things resolved is to work together. I mean, I formed a brilliant relationship with Ian Duncan Smith over the gambling. You know, who would have put me and Ian Duncan Smith together? But, you know, he's someone I would consider to be a friend. You know, and I think there's a lot more of that in you than people acknowledge.
And again, that was another successful campaign, that the fixed odd betting terminals rule was changed in spite of the government trying very hard not to do it. You, along with Ian and Tracy Crouch, were very successful in getting that law changed. And you're very good at using the parliamentary mechanisms. I mean, your regular question of mine at Business Questions, using the floor of the House to get your points across.
Or to recognise someone who may not necessarily get recognition, like a charity that does wonderful work. And, you know, by them getting a mention in this place and by yourself saying something nice about them, the difference that makes to them as an organisation is absolutely phenomenal. So why not use the parliamentary system to give them a leg up?
Well, my office has been working very hard on Commons mentions, and I know we're doing one soon, to thank people who have been mentioned in the Commons. And I think it's a really good thing to do, because throughout our society there are people working hard, doing good things, helping society, who never get thanked. And although saying thank you in the Chamber of the Commons doesn't cost anything, it actually seems to be a really nice recognition for people.
To a lot of organisations, it's better than getting an OBE, because getting a mention in this place, I'm taking Hansard's on about people I mentioned last week. I talked about a cosmetics organisation which gives to help hygiene poverty. That's phenomenal for them that they're actually mentioned in Hansard. It's something that, you know, we can't buy because we're used to it. It's hugely important to them.
Being old-fashioned, I think it looks much better printed in Hansard than it does on the internet. But there's something about that Hansard text. But there is a less pleasant side to all of this. And I wanted to ask you about this because you stepped down on Tuesday as the chairman of the State Pension Inequality for Women, APPG, because of the abuse you've had on social media. Now, you're a pretty robust politician, I think, that you've dealt with very difficult issues. You're a successful campaigner. It must have been pretty extreme to force you to stand down.
Yeah, and it's been sustained. It was one of those campaigns where I believed there was a justice to be put right, but it became a toxic debate in that you had so many different groups who were asking for different things. And some of those groups had no respect for anybody else's opinion. So if you weren't, say, if your narrative wasn't what they wanted to hear, then they would just chuck everything at you. But I mean, my office were getting phone calls. My staff were being abused. And at that point, you've got to say, I'm not doing this anymore. And, I was sad to walk away from it. But it's probably only one group were the worst. But they have damaged the whole campaign for all the other women who now will probably never get what they're asking for, because one group has decided to make things so toxic. It's horrendous.
And you say this was going on for some time and was directed at your staff as well as at you. It must be particularly difficult in lockdown that when people aren't mixing socially, they don't have those support networks that give them the help that they need when they're under attack.
Yeah, and I think Zoom is a wonderful thing, but you can't read somebody's mind when you're at, or you can't see the whites of their eyes, as I like to say, when you're on Zoom. And yeah, I know my staff, they're brilliant, but they were really starting to feel the pressure and were extremely relieved when I said I was going to be standing down. I think within half an hour I'd taken on something else, which my staff said, I thought you said that you were cutting back, and somebody asked me to do something. Oh yeah, I'll do that, because that's, if it needs doing, then I need to do it.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all. But I've certainly noticed with my own staff that the routine criticism that MPs get, that is to some extent part of the job, when you're in a corridor with lots of other MPs' staff who are all getting the same, there is a camaraderie and an understanding. When you're sitting at home all the time, it becomes quite corrosive, and I think that's...
Definitely, and you feel the pain more acutely, and the temptation then is to go in and retaliate, and you know you shouldn't retaliate because it'll make it worse, but sometimes you think, oh, well, I've got to stop myself sometimes.
Well, the advice we all give to people is don't read it, but none of us, I think, stick to that advice for ourselves.
I did retaliate slightly this week. in that the sort of the thing that really convinced me it was time to move away is I'd put something on Twitter about it being the anniversary of my son's passing, and Amber Rudd had come back and said something along the lines of, you know, it was a really good campaign, you were very brave, etc., etc. And then this one particular group had come straight in and said, more fit you stop thinking about yourself and start worrying about 1950s women. And I thought, that's just gone too far now. And at that point, my staff all said, and I said, look, you know, I can't do this anymore, because that was so personal to me. And to do that was... So I did go back this week and say, you know, I hope nobody ever tells you to move on from your son's passing, just to try to make a point. Because and the nastiness doesn't come from political opponents. The nastiness comes from people out there who have a different opinion to you. And it's there's no respect for the fact that we have different political opinions. But I would never go and abuse anybody because I don't agree with their politics. But they seem to think the politicians are easy meat. We can just say what we like, do what we like. And
that's just a deeply cruel thing to have said to you. So unpleasant. And I'm sure you're right to have moved away and let somebody else take it on, that nobody can be expected to ignore that type of abuse. But I was going to ask you, what's your next campaign? What should the government be worrying about?
Oh, well, they should be worrying about online gambling, because that's my big one at the moment. I'm really, really worried about that. And I just would tell you this, I'm not anti-gambling. I've got no problem. You know, I'll go to the bingo myself, and you know, if people want to have a betting horse, I've got no problem with that. It's when people are vulnerable because it's a mental health issue and they constantly get groomed and exploited by an industry which is making obscene amount of money off the backs of desperation and poverty and sometimes death, and no acknowledgement on it.
I've had constituents come to me who have been so badly affected by gambling addiction, and I agree with you, it is a mental health issue and it affects their families, it affects them obviously desperately, it leads to crime in some cases, and it destroys the lives of people who otherwise have every chance to do well. And the online gambling is, well, it's designed to draw people in, isn't it? It's very cleverly done from their perspective.
But that it's a lobby which has got a lot of money, and it's a lobby which is quite aggressive. So we're constantly fighting that one and pushing back. But you know, I won't give in because I know I'm right on it. But I'll always have something on the go. You know, I mean, I'm interestingly enough, I've had somebody's give me mobile phones to give out to the community, which I'm going to do tomorrow. And so if I can get anything which would help the communities that I represent to have a little bit of joy, then that's all I want to do, is to use my position to make life better for other people.
Well, that's a wonderful note on which to end. I shouldn't endorse a Labour Member of Parliament, but I think that's exactly what you do as well. And I think it's wonderful for Parliament that there are people of all parties who do that. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining me in this podcast.
Thank you.